Good morning, and welcome to week two, the hardy, slightly wet. Thank you very much for making it out of the rain. Our series is Zionism, A-Zionism, and Anti-Zionism. So last week, we started out by talking about the roots of different kinds of Zionism biblically, trying to show where they come from within our tradition. And we talked about religious Zionism of different varieties. So we had religious Zionism, meaning religious Zionism, one who seeks to fulfill the religion by coming back to the land of Israel. We also talked about those who believe that being back in Israel brings one closer to God, or might bring the Messiah closer. We talked about types of Zionism that are not religion-focused as well. We had cultural Zionism, the idea that the Jews in their land are able to develop their creativity and their national personality by being there. We talked about political Zionism, the idea of creating a state, whether in terms of a state which would keep Jews safe, or whether in terms of a state where we could fulfill an ideological vision of a better community built around the ideals that are found biblically. Right? All this sounds familiar, I hope. Right? Well, if you weren't here, it sounds familiar. Great. I wanted to just bring one more element to that. One more element of this political Zionism. I mentioned it briefly last week, but I didn't bring the sources for it. I wanted to show it to you in text. And that is Menachem Begin's embrace of this idea of political Zionism, a Zionism in which the ideals of the Bible could be brought to bear to create a state which, in his mind, would be just and would be fair and would take care of its citizens and fulfill the classic vision of who the Jews are meant to be. Now, they've shrunk the aisle in between here, so it's going to be harder for me to like walk back and forth, talk show style. So I hope people in the back don't mind. But if you take a look at the sheets, and again, for anyone who doesn't have, there are more by the hot water. The first couple of excerpts come from a platform that Menachem Begin laid out in a three-hour lecture in 1951. You can see I wrote you a couple of paragraphs called Mercy. But he highlighted the platform he believed in for his Herut political party. Herut meaning freedom, right, meaning freedom. So he has three key elements in his platform. One is the idea of individual freedom. Second, the idea of the supremacy of law. And when he says supremacy of law, what he means is not only there are laws and we need police in order to enforce them. What he means is that everybody is subject to the law. The idea that whatever your position is, whatever authority you hold, you're subject to the same law, and that the laws themselves that are enacted are held to those standards as well, to whatever your foundations are of the law of the nation. You'll see that momentarily. And then third is the idea of social justice. So when he lays this platform out, he anchors all of it in biblical text. Take a look at the first source, please. You'll see what I mean. This is a paper that is actually available online. You could Google the phrases that are in here in order to find it. Are the ideas of a person's freedom and social reform not embodied in the basic fundamentals of Israel's Torah? In a verse which embodies a complete philosophy, because man was created in the image of God. He says, everything I'm going to tell you about what the state of Israel ought to be, about the social reforms that Begin sees, it's all anchored in the idea that human beings are created in the image of God. And then he explains. He says, first, if a man is created in the image of the King of Kings, surely he cannot be a slave who need fear the ruler over him. Second, if in the image of the Creator of all man was molded, surely he will be unable to direct all his thoughts and all his desires to his primary needs, which are also the basic need provisions, if he will suffer from a want of basics. In this verse, you will even find the aspiration for equality. There is no going down or bringing down, but a constant rising or bringing up, inasmuch as man, every man, is created in his image, tell me, when he said that last sentence, there is no going down or bringing down, but a constant rising or bringing up. You know what he's fighting against? Socialism, precisely. It's Begin versus Ben-Gurion. It's Beirut versus the Labor Party. In Begin's mind, socialism operates on a principle that you take those who have achieved and who have accomplished and you bring them down in order to make everybody equal. That's how Begin understands it. So he says, I don't believe in that. You're created in God's image. You don't bring people down. Instead, you elevate everybody. Mind you, his non-socialism has elements that I think are quasi-socialist. He believes in society providing basic needs, and he outlines them elsewhere in his paper, for every citizen. But he says, the commandment, you will love your fellow man as yourself. The rule, man lives not by bread alone, which are both biblical texts. Are they not marvelous expressions of the aspiration for social reform, to abolish suffering and wants? And as regards the supremacy of the law, this is but a characteristic of our nation's history, that in an entire historical period, I add the words in brackets, the period of Yishodim, the judges, after the Jews entered Israel, they were led by Joshua for a period of 28 years, and then after that, they were led by judges for another few centuries. But he says, look at that. The fact that they're called judges, that's the term we use for the leaders of the nation. That in and of itself is meaningful. He said, the nation's leaders and rescuers have been awarded the crown of, quote, judge of all things. And indeed, the words justice and law are an ancient Jewish expression together in one breath. And they have become a saying of Israeli wisdom in one sentence. Justice and law, in Hebrew, tzedakah u'mishpat. From this you may infer that as there is no law without justice, indeed no justice is possible without law. His most basic ideas, his core platform, individual freedom, supremacy of law, he brings a biblical text to support it. In his mind, that's what he is fulfilling. And then I brought you number two, which is about social justice. He says, Israel's prophets and seers, from whom we have inherited the aspiration for justice that guide our repose, elevated visions that are very difficult to realize. There were those that introduced the vision of social justice to, quote, repair the world in the kingdom of God, and those that highlighted the vision of world government. Everyone will make one association. These are also biblical texts. That gave mankind the vision of world peace, and nation will not raise sword against nation. As far as Begin is concerned, political Zionism is rooted in the Torah. And then one last version of Zionism before we get to a Zionism. And this is what I call on here, understanding that the word is a loaded word these days, but it's the only word I can come up with in English that actually fits. And that's the term nationalism. What I mean by nationalism here is a return to the land of Israel in order to join the Jewish nation. In order to be part of the Jewish people. Now you'll say to me, well, I can be part of the Jewish people living in Toronto. I can be part of the Jewish people living in Brooklyn. I can be part of the Jewish people living in France, as long as Jews are living in France. I can be part of the Jewish people wherever I am. You said no. Why not?
Me?
Yes. So, it's an important point that the land doesn't work without the Jew, and the Jew doesn't work without the land, as she said. But that isn't what makes me part of the nation. In other words, it may be true that I can't be complete without being in the land. But why is it that some might argue that I can't be part of the Jewish people without being in the land of Israel? What's that about? We're going to see it soon, but I don't want anybody to get ahead. Sorry? Hmm?
Diaspora.
So? No. Diaspora is a fine Greek word meaning those who are scattered. It indeed applies to us. It applies to Galut. But why couldn't, in what way would residing in the land of Israel make me more a part of the Jewish nation than living anywhere else? I can get to UJA, I can observe the mitzvot, I can have a seder. Like, What is it that's going to make me part of the Jewish nation more because I am living in Israel? Yes? So from Bacon's perspective, that's certainly true. The idea of a commitment to the land being a commitment to the Jewish people. But I'm not post-Bacon. I'm talking about an idea which doesn't rest on Bacon's vision necessarily, but is something that is in fact broader than what he saw. Sheila, and then, hang on, I see Hanson. Yeah, Sheila. So the issue of mixed loyalties, right? When you are living elsewhere, you are loyal, you can be loyal to the Jewish people, but you have an added loyalty, sort of a reverse of the usual dual loyalty allegation. Yes?
Jewish sovereignty.
Yeah, Jewish sovereignty. So if you're in a country that is ruled by Jews, there's, as you say, the complete package there. But I would argue that a nationalist view doesn't even require that the land be ruled by Jews in order to feel like you're part of the Jewish people. There's something else missing that no one has said yet. Bam. So it's true, the biblical text that he says, as Diane points out, that you will be a stranger in a land not your own, and that separates you from your identity, your true identity. But there's one more piece here. I'm going to take Stephen, come in here, and then I'm going to give you what I think is another answer. Yeah.
Daily involvement with the values that a people as a group hold. In other words, when you have your family and your children, your closeness and your interaction is there at that moment in life. Once your children leave and they go in different directions, you still have the caring and love for them, but you don't have that constant involvement in each other's, the meshing of your lives.
So David points out the constant involvement with your nation that you'll have when you're in the land, and I don't dispute that. But there's another element, because you could do the same thing if the Jews were to relocate to Uganda. Right? Then you'd have Jews living in Uganda, you'd be part of a nation there. Yes?
No, I might not answer that, but I think for any nation, if you're living in the poor land, you're part of the ongoing formation of that nation. Mm-hmm. If you're outside, you might be part of the cultural group. You're benefiting from what's gone before, but you're not contributing to the future.
Mm-hmm.
The same as if you were living with the main body of your people.
So you added a phrase there that I think is really important, and that is contributing to the future. Contributing to the future has a lot of different meanings, but I'm going to take it in a particular direction here, because what people in general have talked about, and it's not wrong, is a lateral axis. In terms of who I am associated with today, the population I serve today, the people with whom I identify and live today. But Jewish people don't work that way. We have another axis, and that's through time. I don't know that other nations, certainly other countries, but I don't even know that other nations look at it in quite the same way. Take a look, please, on your sheet. It's verse number 3. And what I think is a fairly good statement of it. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein grew up in the United States, made Aliyah to Israel it was 1971, and became the head of a yeshiva called Yeshivat Har Etzion, also known as Gush Etzion. But look at this description. He says, in the course of my initial visit to Israel during the summer of 1962, I went to visit Moriv Rabbi, Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner Tzatzal, who prior to his Aliyah, often spent the summer at Pension Rank in Jerusalem. After approaching me gently for having left my wife in the United States, and those who read Yiddish would read the Yiddish I left it in, he began to question me regarding my impressions. particularly about what has struck my notice especially. As at that stage, I focused upon the Torah world in Israel. I noted a number of phenomena which had struck me favorably as compared to the American scene. Widespread popular Talmud Torah study. The interaction of the Torah and general communities in the implementation of Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat is the area of Jewish law that deals with business. Every reply was rebutted, with a comment that its subject could have been found in Eastern Europe as well, and so was neither endemic nor unique to Eretz Israel. When he sensed that I had exhausted my material, he pressed on, inquiring as to what indeed was special about my visit. And when it became clear that I could at best only respond feebly, the Rosh Yeshiva opened with a volley of sources and data, the description of Eretz Israel as Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Dereish Ota, a land that Hashem your God cares for, or as that to which Moses and Aaron had been barred access, which was now open to us, all trumpeting forth the sacral, metaphysical, and historical uniqueness of the land, and all causing me to realize in a flash that I had missed the boat entirely. The point that he makes in this essay is, it's not stated exactly as clearly as I thought in the quote that I brought, but part of it is the idea that there's a historical element here. The Jew is connected to every Jew who has ever lived in that land, and to every Jew who ever will live in that land. Being in your national birthplace, when it is a nation that so closely identifies with historical events, with us, nothing has ever been buried, so to speak. Nothing is ever gone. We view events of the past as part of our cultural identity today. And so when you're living in the land of Israel, and this is the view that I call nationalist Zionism, you become part of a nation that is not just the Jews who are living there now, but it's all those who lived there in the past. And if you take a look at number four, this is a quote from a video in which Rabbi Lipinski talked about why it was that he went to Yeshivat Har Etzion, specifically in Israel. And he said, it is, of course, first and foremost, an institution of Torah learning at a high level, located in the foothills of Hebron on one side, Jerusalem on the other. And the very thought that here one stands, engaged in the intensive study of Torah, within the very context that the Avos, the patriarchs, followed on the one hand, or that led of old to Jerusalem on the other, is a source to me of continuing inspiration. It isn't just about what they're studying, it's where they're studying it. This is the idea that the Jew living in Israel is actually joining a nation. He has more, but Lichtenstein has much more to say about it. But I'm going to skip him on this in order to bring us to source number five. Source number five goes back to David, because he does have a statement that is like this as well, within that platform. He says, Israel's historical desires from the day of its exile from its land have found expression in the prayer, renew our days as of old. Right? Indeed, the prayer enfolds within it two national aspirations, liberation of the homeland and concentration of the nation again on its land. Of course, being interdependent, the two historic aspirations of our people who have fashioned this character from generation to generation are, in fact, one aspiration. Liberation of the land and bringing the nation back, they're one and the same. Concentration of the nation is not possible without liberation of the homeland. And every stage of liberation of the homeland would be impossible without some stage of concentration of the nation on its land. You need to bring the Jews back in order to have the land, and you have to have the land in order to bring the Jews back. The movement that carries both these aspirations, which are, quote, the common elements in national consciousness over its classes, diasporas, and generations, is the national movement in Israel. In addition, only a movement that carries both these aspirations in their entirety is a national movement. Any Jewish movement that has become estranged or is estranged from one of them, estrangement from one of the aspirations is inexorably an estrangement from both. It's not a national movement. Whatever Zionist phraseology be as it may. And he's taking another dig at Ben Gurion there. Because what he's saying is, if you believe in trading land for peace, in Bacon's mind, keep in mind that, you know, 25 years later, he would, of course, sign the Sinai Accords. But at this stage, what he says is, if you believe in giving up part of the land, you're not Zionist. It's not a national movement. You need the entire thing, and you need the entire Jewish people. And without it, it's incomplete, and it's not true to its nation. That's Bacon's argument. So this is the last of the visions that we're going to present within Zionism. There's so much more to say, obviously, about the kinds of Zionism, roots of Zionism, which Hama pointed out to me last week. I didn't spend any time at all on the etymology of the word Zion and Zion. This is true. Because what I'm trying to do is to present what the Zionisms of today are and what their biblical roots are. And they grab the word. The word Zion at its core, again, go back to our discussion of last week, is a term that refers to Jerusalem, refers to the Temple Mount, does come to refer to the Jewish people as a whole because they are the residents of Zion. Rachel and I agree to disagree about whether the word Zion can refer to the entire land of Israel. But now I want to take you in a different direction. I want to talk about A-Zionism. A-Zionism means a belief that Zionism isn't necessary in order to be a good Jew. I don't have to be particularly Zionist. I can, you know, believe in the commandments. I can believe in the value of the Jewish people. I can even go and visit the land. But not necessarily to believe in any of these isms. The idea that we should have the land back to develop a new state, the idea that we should come back there in order to fulfill the commandments, all of those. And this is actually a strong view. The A-Zionist view has quite a few adherents within the observer community and beyond. I'm not talking here, I want to be very clear, I'm not talking about inertia. I'm not talking about apathy. I'm not talking about people who believe in Zionism but personally find it difficult to carry out because of economics or because of family or, you know, any of the reasons why somebody might stay outside of Israel while believing that they ought to be there. What I'm talking about here is a coherent philosophy that says we may believe in a Messiah, we may believe that Jews, you know, should end up in Israel, but we don't believe in promoting a national return or a Jewish state. So here's my question to you. Why would somebody be a Zionist? Why would somebody be a believer in the idea that Jews belong there, but not believe that Jews should actually strive to return or strive to have a state? What's the logic? Fear. Fear of what? What does that mean? So fear of being harmed. So I'm leaving out practical considerations. I'm leaving out it's difficult to be there. I'm leaving out it's dangerous to be there. I'm leaving out, we need to have Jews living in other lands to help the other governments of the world be positive towards Israel. I'm leaving out all the practical considerations. We're talking philosophy, Gloria. Right? Waiting for the Messiah. Right? Waiting for the Messiah. God will take care of the return. So someone here, when that was said, I think it was Stephen, said, well, that's anti-Zionism. Not necessarily. Anti-Zionism can be a riff on that. We'll talk about that next week. But the idea that you have to wait for the Messiah, we're going to come back to that. Other ideas? You have anything to say also? Yes? That was then, this is now, we don't believe in it anymore. So that's an even broader idea than I was going to go into, because that to me is just a rejection. In other words, it's not a belief of Jews belong back there. It's not a belief that there should be a Messiah one day. This was a phase in our history, and the world has moved on, and we should as well. But A-Zionism, and you're right, that is an A-Zionist view. But I think you can even find it among those who embrace the value today, but just say, we should be the drivers of it. I'm going to give you four different ideas. One practical and three religious. that promote a Zionism. We'll see how many of the four we get to today. Whatever we don't, that's what next week we pay for. The first one is practical, but not practical like afraid that we're going to get bombed or fear that the Jews cannot make go of it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a fear of false messianism. You name the false messiah in Jewish history without looking at the ones that listed on the sheet. Shabbat Zvi, he's famous, 17th century. Okay, who else? 2,000 years ago, right? Formation of Christianity, that was a big one. Bar Kokhba, also from Roman times. About 15, 20 years ago, I started looking at the false messiah topic and started doing some reading. I never realized just how many false messiahs we have had, great and small. People with, not just like, you know, some guy in a town somewhere with a sandwich board, but people who have had hundreds and thousands at times of followers. It's really striking. Yeah, I basically would have come up with a list that you came up with here. Yeah, I wouldn't have known you then. Take a look at source number 7. Source number 6 is just my list of the 3 elements that a messiah needs, so to speak, or that a false messiah needs in order to gain followers. False messiahs come up when Jews are suffering, when there is general ferment within the community of maybe Messiah is near, such as when there are predictions, mystical predictions that are made that a certain year is coming up. For example, Shabtai Tzvi benefited from messianic ferment in the Jewish and Christian worlds. In the Christian world, there was a belief that the year 1666 was going to be very important, and he is not yet there, but these are the years leading up to it. In the Jewish world, on the Jewish calendar, there was also an association with certain predictions from the Zohar, a core work of Kabbalah. So you need suffering, messianic ferment, and a weakening of traditional institutions. Those who would normally have been the arbiters of is this authentic or is it not, lose the faith of the people or lose their power, that opens the door for a false messiah. So in the Roman era, right, you have suffering under the Romans. You also have, especially as you get to the middle of the second century, the belief that the temple is going to be rebuilt soon. What's the length of time between the first and second temples? So the classic count was 70 years. There's plenty of dispute, don't worry about it. But basically it's a 70-year prediction as listed in Jeremiah. People think to themselves, the second temple was destroyed in the year 68. So as you get to the 130s, everybody is thinking, okay, time for it to be rebuilt. Perfect timing for Bar Kokhba, whose revolt happens then. Bar Kokhba being the warrior who was backed by some of the leading Jewish sages of his day, including Rabbi Akiva, and who led really the last meaningful revolt against the Roman Empire until the fortress of Mazar was destroyed. But it's not just Bar Kokhba. There's a fellow named Judas, the last 20 years or so of the Second Temple. He was killed by the forces of a Roman governor. You move forward in time. The 5th century, Common Era, Moses of Crete. In the 5th century, there's a passage in the Talmud in Sanhedrin which leads to the belief that Mashiach, the Messiah, is going to arrive in either the year 440 or the year 471. And he takes advantage of that. In the year 448, he announces he's going to bring the Jews of Crete out of their diaspora to Jerusalem. He claims to be a reincarnation of Moses, and he leads them to the sea. And of course, the sea isn't going anywhere. But you remember the Midrash about what the Jews did at the sea when they were leaving Egypt? What happens? No. Fellay Nachshon ben Aminadab goes marching into the sea to lead them. That's what they did. But the sea didn't split. And so a whole bunch of them died. And then they said, I guess he's not the Messiah. You know, it sounds almost comical today, but it wasn't very funny then. When you jump to the period of the Crusades, You find more. A fellow by the name of Moses Aldari, he's a Moroccan teacher, gains a large following. He is convinced that the Messiah is going to come and free the Jews from the oppression of the Muslims in that region. The Muslims used to attack them on their way to the Crusades. Jews of Ashkenazi descent are not familiar with this side of the Crusades. I grew up hearing all about the Ashkenazi side of it, which was the Christians on their way to Jerusalem would attack the Jewish communities. But the Muslims are doing the same thing. So this fellow proclaims the date of Pesach, the year 1127, as the date when he will be revealed as the Messiah, and Jews made all sorts of preparations, they sold their businesses, the whole bit. And of course, it didn't come to pass. Goes a Babylonian fellow in Iraq in the middle of the 12th century. His name is David Elroy. He was known to be, according to his family history, a descendant of King David, claimed that he was the Messiah, performed some miracles that made a great impression, of course, miracles to one magician, to another. But he starts a rebellion against the Sultan, saying the time has come and God's armies are going to join forces with the troops of Israel. And he sends a letter to the Jews of Baghdad saying, wait on the roofs of your houses, angels are going to come pick you up and fly you to Jerusalem. Of course, that doesn't happen, and they're waiting. And David's father-in-law accepts a bribe from the Sultan and kills him, kills this Messiah. Then, of course, in further Jewish history, yes, you have Shabbat C in the 17th century, you have Jacob Frank in the 18th century, and you move to the 20th century in Lubavitcher Rebbe. No, in all seriousness. Not that he ever claimed this for himself. But a whole lot of his followers thought that he was the Messiah and did not stop when he was dead. You're talking about, you had all of the different pieces that you needed. You had the suffering of the Jews starting with World War II and moving forward. You had this messianic fervor associated in particular with 1967 and the Six-Day War, and the feeling that this was it, we're back in our land, and now we're going to have a Messiah. And traditional Orthodoxy, with all of its institutions, was very weak in the 60s and 70s. And so the result is, again, this kind of movement could spring up. So there is a fear that Zionism could lead in the same direction. In fact, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel under the British mandate, thought that Theodore Herzl could represent an element of the return of the Jews under the Messiah. There's an idea that's found in the Talmud at the end of Tractate Sukkah, it's built on verses at the end of the book of Zechariah. It's called Mashiach ben Yosef. Anyone familiar with that idea? Mashiach ben Yosef? The Christians love it. Mashiach ben Yosef is what it sounds like, Messiah, son of Joseph. What it means is the following. Traditionally, we're taught the Messiah is a descendant of King David, right? That's the descendant of the Davidic dynasty who will take back the monarchy and so on. However, he's not the only Mashiach. There is the idea of Mashiach, son of Joseph, meaning not son of a man named Joseph, but maybe from the tribe of Joseph. There's a classic split in the Jewish people that goes all the way back to Genesis, and that is the split between the descendants of Rachel and the descendants of Leah. David is from Leah's side, from Judah, Leah's fourth son. On the other hand, Joseph is, of course, from Rachel. He's Rachel's firstborn. And that split manifests many times over the generations. And there is an idea that the first Messiah will be from Joseph's line, and he will lead the Jews to come back to the land, and then he will be killed. He'll fall in battle. And then after that will come Mashiach ben David, the full Messiah, who will lead the Jews the rest of the way. Well, after Theodor Herzl died, Rav Cook delivered a eulogy. I mentioned it in the class at Bethemek last week. Misbeit Yerushalayim, the eulogy in Jerusalem. He never mentions Herzl by name, but he delivered it on the day that Herzl died. And it's called the eulogy in Jerusalem. And there he talks about this idea of Messiah, son of Joseph, who doesn't finish the job, but who starts things going. There was a push after the Six-Day War People wanted to consider David Ben-Gurion or Moshe Dayan as Mashiach Ben Yosef, as the Messiah who's going to start things partway. I brought you a line here in source number 8. Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, talking about Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, son of Rabbi Cook Sr. He said, after the Six-Day War, when a Torah scholar and professor came to our rabbi, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda, and asked him why he could not begin to build the temple, he responded, the mitzvah of building the kingdom of Israel takes precedence, according to the ruling of Maimonides and the beginning of the laws of kings. So when asked why he's not building the temple, does Rabbi Cook, Jr., does he say, well, it's not the Messianic time yet? Is that his answer? No, it's not his answer at all. His answer is because we have certain things that we have to take care of first. That's all. But there's a fear of false messianism, and that is reason number one out of the four that I want to present for a Zionism. A feeling that to embrace Zionism is to risk false messiahs and all of the danger that they bring. What's the danger of a false messiah? Right, and therefore? You're right, he says something's going to happen and it doesn't happen, but? Desperation, loss of faith, and can lead people to do things that are self-destructive. Right, Shabtai Tzvi, in his day, we have a memoir from a woman by the name of Wako from Amsterdam, in which she writes about how her father sold off all the family's assets because he was preparing for a boat trip to Israel. He liquidated everything. That's what you'll have happened with this. And worse, in terms of what it could breed today, if people believe that the Messiah has arrived and that now we have to come back to the land, who knows where this could lead people. And so that's a concern. Second concern, from a religious perspective, is there's no imperative to have to go. Leaving aside messianism, I mentioned it last week, there's debate as to whether there is any mitzvah for a Jew to go live in the land of Israel. I mentioned that Maimonides does not list it in his list of the 613 commandments. So some believe that Maimonides does say it's a mitzvah, just not one of the 613. And there's support for that. Maimonides has a rule, which is from a passage in the Talmud, regarding moving to Israel. I'm tempted to ask this as a question, but I don't want to put anybody on the spot. Okay, so I'm going to ask the question and don't answer. But it's certainly true for people of my generation and my background. How many people, again, don't use, how many people, when they got married, planned, we are going to move to Israel? See, again, I told you not the answer. But how many people, think to yourself, in my generation coming out of yeshiva, that's a dominant approach of saying, we're gonna move there. And some people say, well, we have a 5-year plan first, and we have to finish, getting experience in whatever field we're in, so we'll be able to move there and get a job, or I need to finish this degree in graduate school. People have plans of, I'm going to move there after X number of years. And then, it doesn't always work out. Well, the Talmud discusses the following case. What if a couple is married, and the husband says to the wife, or the wife says to the husband, either way, I want to make Aliyah. I want to move there. And the spouse says, no, I'm not going. What do you do? They don't separate. That's not the rule. The rule presented in the Talmud and ruled that way by Maimonides is the spouse who wants to make Aliyah is able to compel the other spouse to go with them. Whether it is husband or wife, they can compel the other one to go. Now, you'll tell me, well, how do you compel somebody? What does that look like? And the answer would be the ketubah is what it looks like. The ketubah guarantees a sum of money from the husband to the wife in the event that the marriage is dissolved. So the potential argument is, well, if you don't want to go with me to Israel, that the husband could say to the wife, then I don't owe you the ketubah. Or the wife could say to the husband, if you're not willing to accompany me to the land of Israel, then you're going to have to pay me the ketubah. Right? The argument will go either way. But Maimonides, even though he says there's no mitzvah, or doesn't list it in the 613, they should say, still rules that in fact one spouse can compel the other to go. So take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Obadiah Yosef. Some of us learned about him not that long ago. Yeah. No. The question that was asked was, the money that's written in the ketubah could be worth almost nothing at some point in time. So the general principle is that it's not so because people don't live long enough for something to become devalued like that. But in terms of what it, you know, what it'll be worth, because today we don't work with these currencies, right? Meaning the ketubah that I have, this zuzim. No one spends zuzim anymore. But I would go back to what zuzim were worth. I mean, there's a lot to be said about this. I was involved with a law panel that discussed the enforceability or non-enforceability of a ketubah. There's a lot to be said on this topic, beyond this scope. But just to give a frame of reference, people should know, the ketubah lists 200 zuz. In Sephardic communities, they generally add to it. Ashkenazi communities, they tend to leave it as 200 zuz. Anybody know how much a zuz is worth? All of you know. Or most of you know. Yeah. No, half a goat. Half a goat. Right? God got you. The Zabin Abba Vitray Zuzay, that father bought for two zuz. So 200 zuz is 100 goats. So, that's not bad. One husband trading a husband for 100 goats. The cleanup's about the same. Yes. But take a look at source number 9. Rabbi Yosef said, the Megillat Esther, who's a commentary on Maimonides. Megillat Esther, of course, is the book of Esther, but the commentary is named Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther wrote that Maimonides disagrees with others and holds there is no mitzvah of settling Israel after we were exiled from the land, and this is not a mitzvah for the generation. But his words are shocking. In truth, it is clear, in Maimonides' words, in the Yana Chazakah, that's his work of law, that this mitzvah does apply today. And so Maimonides also ruled in his response, and what he's quoting there from Yana Chazakah is this rule about being able to compel to make Aliyah. So he said, of course, Maimonides believes that there is a mitzvah, which is not one of the 613, and there are those who simply disagree with Maimonides' view. So I brought you source number 10, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet Perfetz, who said, one who acquires a field in Israel from a non-Jew performs a mitzvah that is greater than Aliyah. Aliyah is a momentary mitzvah performed for oneself, insufficient to override a rabbinic prohibition. What he's dealing with, I should explain what he's talking about, rabbinic prohibitions. He's talking about the idea found in the Talmud that if the Jew has an opportunity to acquire land in Israel, but it requires that the documents be prepared on Shabbat, so the idea is that he can have a non-Jew be the one to prepare it. Even though that's a rabbinic prohibition, I'm not allowed rabbinically to ask a non-Jew to do things for me on Shabbat, for the sake of settling the land, it may be justified. So he says, for Aliyah, that itself wouldn't do it. But living in Israel is not a momentary mitzvah, but a mitzvah which endures eternally. And if a mitzvah invented for all Israel so that sacred land will not sink in the hands of the impure, he argues, of course, it's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. And he's not interested in Maimonides' idea. There are other ideas, which I brought you here on the sheet. I'm not going to spend time on them, but I wanted you to be able to see it so you can look at it yourself at some point. Those who talk about it as being a very valuable thing to do, even if it's not necessarily a mitzvah. Those who call it a meta-mitzvah, it's broader than any individual mitzvah. There's separate value of living there for the sanctity of Israel. But argument number 2 for the A-Zionist approach is simply to say, at the end of the day, it's not an obligation. So if it's not an obligation, it may be a good thing to do, but I don't need to be a Zionist for it. So those are 2 arguments so far for A-Zionist. Number 1, fear that it will lead to false messiahs, and number 2, I have no duty to do so. The third argument is a very simple and straightforward one. It was put forth in source number 15. Going back to the anthology of commentaries in Talmud called the Tosafot, Rabbeinu Chaim said that, sorry, I should say today, that's a typo. Things that spell check did not check. Rabbeinu Chaim said that today there is no mitzvah to live in Israel, where there are many mitzvot which are linked to the land, and many penalties, and we cannot keep to all of them and live by them. He's writing this 800 or 900 years ago, and he says, for us to be able to leave land fallow every seventh year, for us to be able to separate the tithes, these are challenging and very hard to properly fulfill, and so he says, I see no obligation for a Jew to live there. Keep in mind, if you come from the perspective that Zionism is motivated by a desire to fulfill mitzvot, so somebody says, ah, well, I can't do that, so okay, so don't go. And that's the third approach. The last one that I'm bringing, though, is the one that Gloria mentioned and then others mentioned as well, which is, who is it who's supposed to move the divine agenda? Now, this argument has led in some circles to an anti-Zionist approach, and we'll talk about that next week. But right now I want to present it in terms of the A-Zionists, those who simply argue that it's not for Jews today to move things forward. Let's wait and see what God does. And I brought you the articulation of this idea from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, 19th century Germany, his work Hope. Look at what he says. The original is obviously in German. This is the English translation. He says, not in order to shine as a nation among nations do we raise our prayers and hopes for a reunion in our land, but in order to find a soil for the better fulfillment of our spiritual vocation in that reunion and in that land which was promised and given and again promised for our service of the Torah. He says, why do I pray for a national return to Israel? For spiritual fulfillment. But this very vocation, spiritual vocation, obliges us until God shall call us back to the Holy Land, to live and to work as patriots wherever He has placed us. It obliges us further to allow our longing for the far-off land to express itself only in mourning, in wishing and hoping, and only through the honest fulfillment of all Jewish duties to await the realization of this hope. But it forbids us to strive for the reunion or possession of the land by any but spiritual means. He says, we long for the land, we pray for it, we perform our mitzvot and ask God to bring us back, but that's where it ends. And until we're able to come back, we live and work as patriots wherever He has placed us. And again, he publishes this in Germany in 1840. Yes, Sam?
If God wants all Jews to live in Israel, why does
the rest
2.5 tribes stay
up there? Good question. So Diane asks, if God really wants all the Jews to be in the land of Israel, why does He allow the tribes of Reuben and Gad to live on the other side of the Jordan when the Jews come into the land? In fact, right, it's Reuben and Gad who asked to live there, and then God sends half the tribe of Manasseh. They didn't ask, if you look at the biblical record. So they asked a very important question, to which the answer seems to be that you have to go all the way back to the time of Abraham. And the promise that God made to Abraham, which was that the land of Israel would actually stretch all the way to the Euphrates. So there is potential for that land from the outset. And when you look at the framing of it in the Torah itself, and in Jewish law itself, you find some sources that indicate that that land that Reuben and God live in east of the Jordan is considered part of the land of Israel. It's not considered out, so to speak. And then there are other sources that you can bring biblically that make it sound like, no, it actually wasn't viewed as being part of the land. It has sort of, the status of annexation, if you will. But what's very clear is that once they are told, here is your portion, it is viewed as the land. All the laws that apply on the other side, on the western side of the Jordan, are going to apply to them living on the eastern side of the Jordan. The UN will have to sort it out, but I'll wait for it. The But this idea that Rabbi Hirsch proposes here is the idea that we are not meant to make it happen. We are meant to pray for God to make it happen. Now, towards the end, he actually moves into what could be called an anti-Zionist stance, right? Where he says, really, we're just supposed to do this spiritually. We're going to have to talk about that more. You also don't know, when you read Rabbi Hirsch, how much of what he's saying is political. Meaning, there's a great fear in the 19th century of being seen as other, of not being seen as loyal to your country. These are the early years of the emancipation of Jewish Europe. And emancipation comes always with a demand that the Jews swear fealty to the government of the land. Napoleon assembles his assembly of Jewish notables a few decades before this and asks them the question, if you were fighting in the French army, and you were fighting against the British, and you saw somebody you could identify as a British Jew on the other side, would you fight or anything? Right? That's the question that he puts to the Jews, and the wrong answer is going to mean, you will not be emancipated, you will be stuck in your ghetto, you will not be able to participate in society, at best. So, he's writing in an environment in which saying, we actually don't want to stay in this land, is loaded in some way dangerous. And that's something that you have to keep in mind as you read what he wrote. But in general, the idea that Jews are not meant to move this forward is a very old idea. The idea that history is moved by God and not by human beings is a very old idea. Take a look, please. At source number 17 on your sheet, this is one passage of many. The prophet Zechariah. God promises that he will be a wall of fire for the Jews, surrounding them. This is taken as an understanding that God is going to build the third temple and that he will make the wall as a wall of fire around us. He is the protector. He is the builder. There's a lot of debate rabbinically about whether that means that human beings are involved in construction of the temple at all. There's biblical evidence that the Messiah is something that is given to us, not something that we create. Take a look at source number 18. Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is meant to present the love between God and the Jewish people as though it were a love between human beings. And three times in Song of Songs, you find a variation on the following verse, in source number 18. God says, Hishvati etchem benot Yerushalayim. I have made you swear, daughters of Jerusalem. Im ta'iru v'imta'aru etha ahava ashekechatz, lest you awaken and lest you arouse the love when you desire it. In other words, God says, it's not your timetable. It's not for you to decide it's time for the Messiah. I don't want you to do it. And he says, I made you swear. Very strong language saying that. But that's the language that's used. Another example of this, prediction of Jeremiah in source number 19. For so says God regarding the vessels that remain in the house of God and in the house of the king of Judah in Jerusalem, these are the last years of the first temple, they, the vessels, will be brought to Babylon, and there they will remain until the day I remember them, says God. And I will bring them up and return them to this site. It's not for you. God said, I'll take care of it. Until then, stay in Babylon. That's the argument. And that was, in fact, one more passage, sorry. Source number 20 from the book of Isaiah, chapter 44. This is a classic. Thus said the Lord your Redeemer, who formed you in the womb. It is I, the Lord, who made everything, who alone stretched out the heavens and unaided spread out the earth, who annulled the omens of diviners and made fools of the augurs, who turned sages back and made nonsense of their knowledge, but confirmed the word of my servant and fulfilled the prediction of my messengers. It is I who say of Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited, and of the towns of Judah they shall be rebuilt, and I will restore the ruined places. I who said to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up your floods. I am the same who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He shall fulfill all my purposes. He shall say of Jerusalem, she shall be rebuilt, and to the temple you shall be founded again. In case that wasn't clear, because, you know, for many people this may not be the 100th time they've read it. In this passage, Given to the prophet Isaiah before the first temple is destroyed, God predicts the return of the second temple. And not only that, he names the Persian king who is going to defeat the Babylonians and bring us back. This is why historians have a really hard time with the book of Isaiah. Because Isaiah is speaking to Jews who have never met any Persians, who have yet to be conquered by the Babylonians. And he says to them, yes, you will be in exile, and you're going to come back, and the one who's going to bring it back is going to be a king, Cyrus, who, by the way, hasn't been born yet. Maybe he was Cyrus the second, so maybe Cyrus the first was born. But that's the promise. So look at the wording of the promise. I, it's filled with the first person. I am the one who does this. I am the one who will do this. I am the one that's going to tell Cyrus what to do. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one, whose right hand he has grasped, treading down nations before him, unburdening the loins of kings, opening doors before him, letting no gates stay shut. I will march before you and level the hills that loom up. I will shatter doors of bronze and cut down iron bars. I will give you treasures concealed in the dark and secret hoards, so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by name. It's very clear that God is the one who's going to bring this messianic time, and it's not for us to trigger it. Which is why, when you flip the page, as I'm struggling to do, source number 21. A sage by the name of Rabbi Abba wants to make Aliyah. You're going back in this story to the end of the 3rd century, maybe beginning of the 4th. He lives in Babylon. Rabbi Abba wants to make Aliyah. His mentor is Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda does not believe that one should go back. He believes that it's for God to do. So Rabbi Abba does what Jews have always done in such circumstances, which is avoid the wrath. Right? That's what he does in such circumstances. Rabbi Abba avoided Rabbi Yehuda because he wanted to ascend to Israel. Rabbi Yehuda had ruled that one is not supposed to go. So he said, all right, fine, I just won't tell him. That was supposed to be the answer. Of course, those stories never work out. And as the passage keeps on going, he ends up encountering him and having the debate, which we're going to have to come back to next week in terms of what the actual debate is. But here you see the tension. Right? Here you see that he wants to go, and his rabbi, his mentor, says you're not allowed to go. And take a look at source number 22. That's the last one that we'll do. When the Talmud asks about the passage in Shir HaShirim, Shvat Yevhem, I make you swear that you shall not awaken the love until this time, what is the purpose of these three oaths? Three demands. Number one, that the Jews should not ascend as a wall, meaning we're not to take back the land. Two, that the Jews should not rebel against the nations. Three, that the nations should not overly oppress the Jews. I know, they didn't read the time. So what we're going to have to see, we're going to talk about this more, is that but this is the last, and to a certain extent the most potent, of the A-Zionist arguments. It says, God already told us it's for him to bring us back. So until then, I'm going to live a good Jewish life in Toronto, or in New York, or in Europe, or in Asia, wherever it's going to be, and on the day that God wants me back, he'll bring me back. That, along with the other arguments that we make, the argument that it's hard to fulfill all the laws in the land of Israel, the argument of fear of false messiahs, the argument that there is no mitzvah, there's no imperative for somebody to come back, all of these contribute to the A-Zionist appeal. So what I want to do next time is spend a little bit of time just giving the response to this. In other words, so what does the Zionist say back? If it's so clear, you have Talmudic sources, but biblical sources saying God does it, so why is there any discussion about this? What's the other side to this? Before moving into anti-Zionism, and the reasons why there are those who will not just say, I'm not going, but saying nobody should go. So we'll pick up with that, if I'm willing, next week. Thank you again for coming out in the rain. Hopefully it'll be dry next week.